This is the Relic Radio Show, old-time radio entertainment still standing the test of time, from RelicRadio.com. This week on the Relic Radio Show, we'll begin our hour of radio drama with Favorite Story. We'll hear their adaptation of Moby Dick, aired February 14th, 1948. After that, it's You Are There and the Stamp Act Rebellion, their episode from March 19th, 1950.
This is Ronald Coleman, inviting you to radio's most dramatic half hour, Favorite Story. What does whiteness mean to you? If something is white in color, it may mean that it is pure or very impure. The face of a saint gleams with whiteness, but so does the face of a leper. They tell us that ghosts are always clothed in white. The hood of the cobra, charged with poisonous venom, is white as the standards of the kings of France. And can you dream of any place more lonely and terrifying than the ice fields of the Arctic? Our favorite story this week concerns something white and something terrifying. Captain Ahab sailed his ship around the world in pursuit of it, and what happened to him and his crew is told in Melville's adventure of Moby Dick, the White Whale. This is a novel of hatred and revenge, and many critics have called it the greatest book written in America. The man who chose Moby Dick as his favorite story is a distinguished American author himself, Mr. Howard Lindsay, who collaborated in the writing of Life with Father, State of the Union, and other Broadway hits. Perhaps you saw Mr. Lindsay as the famous father in his own famous play. We hope you will enjoy our production of his favorite story, which stars William Conrad as Captain Ahab and Howard Duff as Ishmael. Here's Act One of Moby Dick.
Call me Ishmael, an ordinary seaman before the mast on the good ship Pequod, bound out of Nantucket on Christmas Day of the year 1844, on a 1,000 days voyage.
Up the ropes with you. Stand the mast head, Tad. Keep your weather eye open. Sing out if you smell a whale.
Aye, Mate Starbuck. Me stand mast.
Well, Ishmael, is your blood frozen stiff yet? Is there ice in the marrow of your bones?
It's a cold night, sir. That wind has the teeth of Greenland in it.
Well, come below to my cabin, Ishmael.
Aye, Mr. Starbuck, gladly.
A round of black coffee will do the both of us good. What a devil's crew this is. The heathen helmsmen, Fiji Islanders, cannibal from the Congo, tattooed harpooner from the brink of the pit. What are you doing in this motley crowd, Ishmael?
I'm one of them.
You're an intelligent man. Seen the inside of colleges, no doubt. What makes you ship on a 3-year whaling cruise before the mast, eh?
Some men end their troubles with suicide. I take to the sea.
We may all of us be dead before this madness is ended. Ah, here's the coffee. Hot and black. Drink up, Ishmael. To the Pequod. A crazy crew. And a crazy captain.
Where is Captain Ahab?
3 feet away from the pot. Ah, directly above your head. The floor of his cabin is the roof of mine. You'll hear him presently.
Isn't it strange, sir? I've never sailed with a whaling ship before, so I don't know, but isn't it strange for a vessel to be 5 days out of port and no one yet set eyes on the captain?
Aye, it's strange indeed. Captain Ahab was always a strange man. Now he's stranger than strange. He keeps close inside his cabin, never seems to sleep. He's sick, I believe, but he doesn't look so. The sickness is hid deep inside him.
Then why did you ship with Captain Ahab?
He's a good whaler. He's a good captain. More than that, he's Ahab. And if you remember your Bible, Ahab was crowned king.
A very wicked king.
That's true, a very wicked king.
What's that?
Ah, there he goes again. There goes Ahab on the march. Night and day he pounds into my sleep. I have no rest from Ahab.
Is he hammering the floor?
Aye. He hammers whatever he walks on.
You mean, Mr. Starbuck, that our captain has only one leg?
Ahab has 2 legs, my boy. One of them like yours. The other, whittled from the jawbone of a sperm whale.
Salt air, mate. Get away, Mr. Starbuck. I need none of your help. It's a fair wind. What's our course?
South by southeast, sir.
Fair wind, fair course. Mr. Starbuck, send everybody aft.
Sir.
The whole crew. Masthead, sir. Come down.
Is this an emergency, Captain, that you want every man to quit his work?
Did you hear me, Mr. Starbuck? Send everybody aft.
Aye, sir. Helmsman, lash the tiller. Make for the quarter.
Aye, sir.
Carpenter.
Hurry along there,
Starmaker, aft all of you.
Hurry along there.
We'll get a look at all they have at last.
They're all assembled, sir. All hands present.
Good. Good. Turn me your best, dear lad. I've sweet words for you. What do you do when you see a whaleman?
Sing out for him.
Aye. And what do you do next, men?
Lower away.
Lower away and after him.
And what tune is it you pull to, men?
A dead whale or a stove boat?
Aye, that's the tune.
You, Tashtego and Dago. Old Maxman there, we've spat harpoons at many a sperm whale's fluke, haven't we, lad?
Aye, that we have.
Then you've before now heard me give orders about the white whale. Look ye. Do you see the Spanish ounce of gold? A $16 piece, men. Do you see it? Mr. Starbuck, hand me yon topmore.
Aye, sir.
Nailed to the mast, you'll find it, lad. Iron against wood against gold. Whenever you work above decks, men, you'll see this gold piece nailed here, glimmering down on you like a second sun. And whosoever of you raises me a white-headed whale with a wrinkled brow and a crooked jaw, whosoever of you raises me that white-headed whale with 3 holes punctured in his starboard fluke, he shall have this ounce of gold, my boys.
A gold ounce for a white whale.
You want some,
it's a white whale, I say, so skin your eyes for him, man. Look sharp for white water. And if you see but a bubble, sing out.
Captain Ahab, sir, that white whale must be the same that some call Moby Dick.
Moby Dick. You know the white whale then, blacksmith?
Does he fantail a little curious, sir, before he goes down?
And him have 2, 3, oh, good many iron in him high.
Aye, Tashtego, the harpoons lie all twisted and wrenched in him. Aye, Perth, he fantails like a split jib in a squall. It's Moby Dick you've seen. Moby Dick.
Captain Ahab. Was it not Moby Dick that took off your leg?
Who told you that? Aye, Starbuck. parties all round. It was Moby Dick that dismasted me. Moby Dick that brought me to this dead stump I stand on now. Aye, it was the white whale that received me, made a poor pegging lover of me forever and a day. Aye, and I'll chase him round Good Hope and around the Horn and round Perdition's flames before I give him up. And this is what you've shipped for, men. To chase that whale till he spouts black blood and rolls fin out. What do you say, men? Will you splice hands on it now? God bless you. God bless him. Wait. Hold me, hearties. Mr. Starbuck, what's the long face about? Wilt thou not chase the white whale? Art thou not game for Moby Dick?
I'm game for his crooked jaw and for the jaws of death, too. If they come fairly in the way of the business we follow. But I came here to hunt whales, not my commander's vengeance.
You're shipped as first mate to Captain Ahab, and you'll follow Ahab's orders.
Vengeance on a dumb brute that simply smote thee from blindest instinct? That's madness, blasphemy!
Talk not to me of blasphemy, man. I'd strike the sun if it insulted me. Now swear with me, lads. Death! Death to Moby Dick!
He's mad.
No, Schmel. Would he were mad. For madness is a wild, uncalculating thing. We could cope with madness. But Ahab is madness gone mad.
Did you ever catch sight of Moby Dick, Mr. Starbuck?
No, not I. But I've heard old-timers talk about the gleaming whiteness of his hump. They talk of his cunning, how he'll dive to the ocean's bottom dragging the whale boats with him. How one flip of his leprous tail has crushed a boatload of brave seamen.
How old is Moby Dick?
How old? Moby Dick was churning white water through the Straits of the Indies before Columbus sailed for the New World. Enough of this talk about the white whale. Back to your watch, man. There's still an hour yet before daybreak.
Mr. Starbuck, what noise is that?
There's a light up by the forecastle.
Looks like fire, sir.
It's the forge.
These are the nails up from a steel shoes of racing horses.
Captain Ahab, this is the best steel we blacksmiths ever worked.
Hammer it, old man. These stuff well together like glue from the mounted bones of murderers.
There's a fine pair of lucifers.
What are they about, sir?
Forging a harpoon from the appearances of things.
Hammer it, I say, old man. Make the sparks fly.
Eh?
Here, give it me, the hammer. My hand is no stranger to the anvil. Work the bellows first, man. The coals white hot. Faster, man, faster with the bellows. This land must be a perfect effort for the work it has to do.
I fear something, Captain Ahab. Is this harpoon for the white whale?
Oh, the white fiend. There. Now, cold water for the bucket. We will temper the steel thus. Ego non baptizo te in nomine patris et in nomine diaboli. In nomine diaboli.
What does he say?
He baptizes the harpoon, not in the name of the Holy Father, but in the name of the unholy demon, Satan himself.
God keep us. God save us all.
Ready for Act Two of Howard Lindsay's favorite story, Moby Dick, by Herman Melville. Aboard the Pequod, Captain Ahab watches the black waters for a sign of the giant white whale. Round the world he pursues his vengeance, for there's no man alive who can stand between Ahab and his rendezvous with Moby Dick.
On we sailed. Southward across the equator, along the breast of the Brazilian coast, around the rocky, storm-bound tip of Patagonia, Magellan's misnamed Land of Fire. The Pequod cut the foam of the Pacific northward toward the coral atolls of the East Indies. Many days and nights on this long voyage, the watch on the masthead sang out.
No!
Where, masthead? What quarter?
3 points to starboard, Captain Mayhap!
What color is a masthead?
Shall we be after him?
No.
Sir, there's 100 barrels of whale oil there.
I said we don't lower a boat.
A fortune in the Nantucket market. You'll pass it by, Captain Ahab?
I'll pass it by.
What of the owners?
Curse the owners. We sail from Moby Dick.
Brisk winds knifed the Pequod onward. Sails of other whaling ships loomed almost daily on the horizon. And whenever the masthead sighted one, old Ahab pegged to the rail of his quarterdeck to ask the same inevitable question.
Ahoy there! Hast thou seen the white whale?
Some had seen Moby Dick, some had not. But these were the seas where the white whale swam. Captain Ahab's nostrils twitched. His eyes glistened as the good ship Rachel swung alongside. Her master came over the rail.
I have seen the white whale yesterday.
You saw him?
Aye. A whale boat we lowered after him is lost. I pray you will help us find it. If we scour the sea hereabouts, sailing in parallel lines a few miles apart, we are sure to find my whale boat in a few days.
And by then, Moby Dick will be spouting in the China Sea. No, I'm after him.
I pray you, sir, for the sake of Christian charity. My son, my only son, a lad of 12 years, was in that whale boat.
I'm sorry for your loss of your son, but I cannot help you.
Let me charter your ship. I'll gladly pay for it, and roundly, for 8 and 40 hours only. Help me find my son.
Which way was the white whale heading when you lost him?
Eastward. Due east.
Helmsman, change our course. Due east.
You will not help me.
If thy son is drowned, he's drowned. It's none of my concern.
For the love of God, I pray. I beseech.
Over the side with thee. Mr. Starbuck, help the master of the Rachel back to his own deck. Our business lies eastward.
Ye have no human soul, no sympathy. If ye find the white whale, he shall kill thee. It will be God's vengeance.
Ye speak to me of vengeance, sir. Know ye not that Ahab and vengeance are one and the same? Avast, Mahares! The smell of him is in the wind! The blasted staff of me aches with his nearness! An ounce of Spanish gold, lads, for the first eye that catches light from the back of Moby Dick!
Captain Ahab, the storm is rising. I'll let down an anchor to the windward and strike the mainsail.
Strike nothing and stir nothing, but flash everything. The wind rises. Let it rise. You take me for the hunchback skipper of some coasting smack? No, Mr. Starbuck, we ride the wind. Whose is the masthead?
No one, Captain.
No watch? No masthead?
We can't send a man up in this gale.
Shall we overrun him then? Shall we miss our meeting with Moby Dick because no eyes were peeled to watch for him?
Who can see in this night?
I can. For the lightning flashes, I'll see him. Ahab himself will man the masthead.
You, sir? How will you brace yourself?
A rope under the armpits. Hoist me, Starbuck. I'll tie myself to the yard arm. And if Ahab's eye is the first to see the chalky plumes of Moby Dick, then Ahab shall have the ounce of Spanish gold.
The day dawned. Slate gray calm. And with the first pale light on the water, heard old Ahab's voice sing out from the masthead.
Hard she blows! Hard she blows!
White to leeward. White to snow is he.
Barry! Barry! All Moby Dick
together! Sail stanchions alone aloft on both sides. Blow me, Mr. Starbuck.
Who was the first to spy the white whale?
Me spy him. Me see him almost same time Captain Ahab.
Not the same instant fate reserved the doubloon for me. I only. There she blows. There she blows. Look at that smoke. Again. Again.
Watch him, Captain. He's heading straight to leeward, sir. Straight away from us. Can't have seen the ship as yet.
Quiet. Quiet, all of you. Row the boats gently. No unnecessary sound to alarm Moby Dick. We'll after him on the silent wings of an avenging angel.
Captain, it's not too late to turn back. Look ye, Moby Dick does not seek you. It is you, sir, you that madly seeks after him.
Do you think, Starbuck, I've come so far to turn back now? Brace forward up helm. We'll follow the white whale's wake, though he lead us to the gates of the Inferno.
For 3 days, the Pequod sailed ahead of the wind, always within sight of Moby Dick. Ahab never slept, the harpoon always at his side. On the third day, Moby Dick hung to the leeward, tiring perhaps from the long chase. Ahab ordered the boats lowered.
Starbuck.
Aye, Captain.
For the third time, a soul ship starts upon this voyage.
Aye, sir. You will have it so.
Some ships sail from their ports, and ever after were the missing, Starbuck.
Truth, sir. Saddest truth.
Some men die at ebb tide, some at low water. Some at the full of the flood. And I feel now like a billow that's on its way out of men's sight. I am old, Starbuck. Shake hands with me, man.
Captain, turn back. There still is time.
You never wanted this chase after Moby Dick, did you, Starbuck? Why did you follow me, then?
You are my captain, sir.
Farewell, Starbuck. God rest you.
Roll away! Stand by the crew!
Look, Captain, the sharks! They circle your whaleboat!
Sharks? Good! Their teeth shall bite the flank of Moby Dick along with my harpoon!
The boats moved closer. Closer to the white whale. He lay quietly in the water as if waiting for Ahab to come to him. Then, when the distance between the foremost boat and the great whale was less than 20 yards, Moby Dick made a sudden turnabout and faced directly toward the crippled captain.
Beware, sir. The size of him. That wrinkled brow.
Forward to forward I meet thee, Moby Dick, after the long years. Do you remember me? Do you know me? You must know me. You've swum through my thoughts. You've never left me since you blasted old Ahab's body in another sea. Do you feel me? I'm but a flake of foam compared with thee. In size and age and strength, thou art my master. But I am a man. There's a spirit in this body that thou blasted, Moby Dick. And the spirit of Ahab will follow thee, even down the darkening staircase to the ocean's floor.
The sharks are chewing away the oars, Captain.
Let them. This shall be quick work. Towards thee I roll, thou all-destroying but unconquering whale. To the last I grapple with thee. For hate's sake, I spit my last breath at thee. Last I give up the fear.
Ahab's harpoon sailed from his hand, struck the whale's flank. Moby Dick lashed about, enraged by the pain, maddened by the spear in his flesh. Within seconds, the three whale boats were crushed by that enormous tail. Then the wrinkled brow of Moby Dick smote the good ship Pequod full amidships. And she sank forever, with all her officers and crew, into the shark-infested waters of the Java Sea. I escaped the sharks. On the second day, a sail drew near and picked me up at last. Thus ends my story of the dreadful vengeance of Captain Ahab. Or was it the even more dreadful vengeance of Moby Dick?
You've been listening to our favorite story impression of Herman Melville's Moby Dick. Three of the brightest young stars of motion pictures were our leading players. William Conrad played Captain Ahab, Frank Lovejoy was Starbuck, and Howard Duff was our narrator, Ishmael. Claude Sweeten provided the score, and Mr. Howard Lindsay chose Moby Dick as this week's favorite story. When you think of Charles Dickens, you probably think first of David Copperfield, Oliver Twist, and company. But there's a lesser-known Dickens novel that's a real thriller, Great Expectations. That's next week's favorite story. And it was chosen by one of the great actors of our century, Mr. Walter Hamden. We hope you'll be listening.
Capital city of the colony of Virginia. And this is the bitter, the dreaded morning of November 1st, 1765, the day the Stamp Act is to go into effect. But here before the House of Burgesses is a seething crowd determined that the act shall not go into effect. These angry colonists are face to face with the loaded muskets of Governor Fauquier's militia drawn up across the square. The guards are quite as determined as the protesting crowd and ready for anything. People have been waiting here since dawn now for the arrival of George Mercer, the new tax collector sent from England by King George III, with orders to enforce the Stamp Act, no matter how vehemently the colonists protest. Whether he'll be able to do so in the face of the angry mood of the colonists remains to be seen. Anything is possible. George Mercer is a native of Virginia and was once regarded as a neighbor and friend. But he arrives today...
November 1st, 1765... Williamsburg, Virginia. The American colonists challenge the enforcement of the English Stamp Act. You are there.
The people of Williamsburg enact the prologue to the American Revolution, a decade before the shot that was heard round the world. CBS takes you back 185 years to the morning when the colonists rose up against the Stamp Act, the symbol of British autocracy and parliamentary dictation. All things are as they were then, except for one thing. With all the modern facilities of radio present and CBS newsmen reporting from the scene...
You are there!
You are there is based on historical fact and quotation. And now...
November 1st, 1765... The green before the Capitol in Williamsburg, Virginia, and Bill Leonard.
From the very first, there's been strong and often violent resistance to the Stamp Act throughout the American colonies. It was here only 5 months ago, on May 30th, 1765, that the first public opposition to this tax was hurled at the English Parliament and King George III by Williamsburg's House of Burgesses. A young lawyer, Mr. Patrick Henry, who's standing beside me now, introduced a series of resolutions condemning the Stamp Act and the House of Burgesses passed them. These Virginia resolutions, as you know, started a fire of protests against the royal government that has swept over the colonies in America to such an extent that today active demonstrations are shaking the traditional calm of these English colonies. Demonstrations that may even result in mob violence. Later in the course of this broadcast, we hope to call in our correspondents in Boston and New York and perhaps other points for a roundup of events at those places. But now, Mr. Patrick Henry has consented to repeat, at the risk of personal danger and possibly imprisonment, I might add, the remarks he made last May in the House of Burgesses.
Those were very mild remarks to what I can really say.
Your remarks, however, were considered far from mild, Mr. Henry.
They appear to have been strong enough for me to have been called an incendiary and a traitor. Traitor! It is not I who am the traitor, but rather those aristocratic ostriches sitting in the House of Commons in London with their heads in their purses and their hands in the pockets of the common people.
By the common people, Mr. Henry, I presume you mean the colonists here in America upon whom the tax will fall.
Not them alone. In my resolution, I said that this tax will destroy British as well as American freedom. And I meant just that. This act puts a tax on every broadside, newspaper, and pamphlet, every bill, note, deed, and bond, every lease, every license, insurance policy, ship's clearance papers, why, even college diploma. This tax strikes at the very heart of our commerce, down to the smallest private transaction. Now, no proud people can accept such interference with their affairs, especially when imposed without their consent by royal prerogative men who live in comfort 3,000 miles away.
Yes, but how does that affect the people in England who, as you say, are 3,000 miles
away? It affects them very directly and where they are most sensitive. American merchants already refuse to import or buy goods made in England. And as a result, there is a depression in British business and a depression in employment. Therefore, I say that the people in England may suffer even more from this tax than we will.
Well, Mr. Henry, we've tried to get a copy of the full resolution that you made last May, remember, in the House of Burgesses, but we've been having some difficulty, and I wonder...
Of course you've been having difficulty. The heart of my resolutions were expunged from the journals the very next day after they'd been passed. Expunged by a vote of some of our timid Virginia lawmakers who fear the fury of King George. But we will convince them, too.
Mr. Henry, you said you'd repeat your resolution against the Stamp Act for us here on CBS.
Of course I will. I said that the General Assembly of this colony shall have the sole right and power to levy taxes on its inhabitants.
And that's when the Speaker of the House cried out treason.
Yes, and that is when I said to the House, Caesar had his Brutus, Charles I his Cromwell, and George III may profit by their example. If this be treason, I said, make the most of it.
Do you think, sir, that George Mercer will profit by the example of this demonstration and decide against enforcement of the...
George Mercer is merely a dupe of George III. He does not have an altogether free choice in the matter. The citizens will help him to reach that decision. Here, today...
Thank you, Mr. Patrick Henry. There's still no sign of the coach bringing George Mercer to Williamsburg, but there is a lady standing beside me. She's holding a small boy by the hand, and she looks as if she took exception to Mr. Henry's remarks.
Well, of course I do. All this wild talk, all these demonstrations. It's disgusting.
Would you tell us your name, please?
Agatha Sterrett. This is my son, Charles.
Hello there. Mrs. Sterrett, I take it that you're not supporting the citizens here in this demonstration.
All I want is peace. Nothing but peace.
Are you in favor of the Stamp Act, then?
Oh, why must people always be for something or against something while children suffer and food is taken out of their very mouths? I just want peace. Ever since these protests started, my husband hasn't brought a shilling into the house.
What does your husband do for a living, Mrs. Sterrett?
He's in business. Or he was.
What sort of business is that?
In the import-export trade. Our home's here in Williamsburg.
I see, and since so many merchants have signed non-importation agreements and refused to trade in English goods, your husband's business has been affected, is
affected?
That it?
Affected? It just doesn't exist anymore. How am I to feed my children? How can I send them to school with tattered clothes? Oh, these demonstrations, this stupid, stupid business. Why, some people are even saying there will be a call to arms. Just imagine, armed resistance against the king. I say what we need are some cool heads to talk peace, to get business going again. Charles, come back here, come back.
Thank you, Mrs. Sterrett. I'd venture to say that Mrs. Sterrett represents a pretty sizable body of public opinion. While the crowd around me is literally seething with unrest, the fact is that a number of people would just like to see this whole conflict peaceably resolved one way or the other so they can resume their normal lives. But the chances are that they'll not see this happen without... George Mercer has arrived. His carriage has just come into sight. It's coming down Duke of Gloucester Street toward the Capitol here, and the crowd is shouting and booing. Some people are brandishing clubs and pitchforks. Others are shaking their fists at him. The militia's having trouble holding the crowd in check. The people are straining against the governor's guard, trying to push their way through to the carriage. These people are shouting, "Down with Mercer," and the slogan, "Liberty, property, and no sin." The carriage is going down the path cleared by the guard. No, the crowd has broken through the line of militiamen. They've broken through and they surround the carriage. And now they've forced it to a stop a few yards from us here, very close to us, before the steps of the Capitol. Now Governor Fauquier, the royal governor of Virginia, is rushing out of the Capitol, heading toward the carriage. Now the door of the carriage is open. Someone wrenched it open. George Mercer is crossed inside. From my position here before the Capitol, I can see him quite clearly. There's a look of stunned surprise on his face. I'd say that he had no inkling that he was going to get this kind of reception. The crowd's milling around his carriage, shouting and threatening, but no one has touched Colonel Mercer yet. They're busy, too busy struggling with the guards who are trying to reestablish their lines around the carriage. Governor Fauquier is pushing his way through the crowd now, shouting for quiet. The guards are beginning to force the crowd back. They've reformed their lines, pressing the crowd back away from the carriage. I must say, the guards are not using their muskets. They're not getting rough. They push with their hands and try to block off the crowd with their bodies. They seem to be under orders not to shoot or harm the colonists. Governor Fauquier has pushed his way through the crowd now, and he stands in the clear space near the carriage, protected by the guards from the angry crowd, shouting for quiet again, and people here are beginning to calm down. We're trying to get as close to the carriage as possible in order to hear what the governor has to say. Will you excuse me, please? I've got to get you on from CBS here. Let me say thank you. I'm close to the inner circle of the crowd now. Just behind the line of guards, you can probably hear Governor Fauquier trying to get quiet, and successfully, too. The people here are quieting down, except for an occasional shout at George Mercer. The royal governor, very popular and greatly respected by most Virginians, which is probably the chief reason that this crowd is stopping to listen to him now. Governor Fauquier has his hand up.
George Mercer is here under orders from His Majesty King George III. I can therefore permit no interference with his person. He has my official protection, and I must order you to disperse, to return to your home, to let him pass in peace.
Wait! Governor Fauquier has ordered the crowd to disperse and go to their home. You can hear their answer. They're not moving.
Wait! Listen! Fellow Virginians, listen to me. It's senseless to protest this way, to endanger life and property, when George Mercer is simply carrying out orders that are not his own making. He has no alternative but to follow those orders.
He has! Tell him to burn the stamps! We don't want the stamps!
Burn the stamps!
Burn the stamps!
Burn the stamps! Burn the stamps! Please, gentlemen, please!
Colonel Mercer has just arrived from Ireland. He knows nothing of your sentiments or of the issues involved in this matter. He's had a tiring journey, a long journey. Give him rest. Give him until Friday to decide whether...
One moment, please.
Please, gentlemen, let us not have violence done to an old friend.
No friend of ours! He's no friend of ours!
This is the first that our friend George Mercer is acquainted with your disapproval of the Stamp Act. Give him time to determine the real sentiments of his countrymen.
Down the act.
Let him speak now.
He will speak.
But
But give him at least time to nourish himself with a hot cup of coffee. I personally promise you, citizens, that George Mercer will have a statement for you in a quarter of an hour. A quarter of an hour, no longer. And you know I'll keep my word. Now let us go to the coffee house. Make way, please.
Has taken Colonel Mercer by the arm. Now he heads straight for the crowd. He's going to try to walk right through that angry mass of people to escort Colonel Mercer to the Raleigh Tavern. The crowd chanting, one and all, stick together, one and all. I can't predict what will happen here, but nobody can deny that the governor is an extremely courageous man. Now the guards have cleared a lane through this crowd, and the governor and Mercer are slowly walking through. No one's made a move toward them yet. They're about halfway through the gauntlet. Now some of the people are waving their clubs and pitchforks, and no one makes a move toward the governor or Mercer. The governor seems to be winning this battle of nerves. Now they're clear of the crowd. They pass right through and are headed across Capitol Square toward the Raleigh Tavern. They pass through this angry crowd unharmed, not a hair touched. The crowd is waiting here, discussing the events of the past few moments. They appear no less angry, no less determined than they were when George Mercer first arrived. That fact must be clear to any observer. And while we wait for George Mercer's answer, one way or the other, let's go for a quick roundup of developments in other cities here in the English colony. First, for an analysis from Quincy Howe in our CBS studios, then to New York and Boston. Come in, Quincy Howe.
The British appear to have bitten off quite a bit more than they can chew. This is not only the considered opinion of many American colonists, many good Englishmen feel exactly the same way. The truth is that English opinion is split wide open. The landed nobles favor the Stamp Act. The merchants oppose it. The nobles want to collect taxes at any price. The merchants want to do business at any price. The French and Indian War left England with a national debt of between 130 and 140 million pounds. Who's going to pay for this? Well, British political leaders like George Grenville, First Lord of the Treasury, give this reply. The Englishman at home is heavily burdened with taxes already. Let's tax the Englishman in America. And that's what tax collector George Mercer is supposed to do, make the American colonists pay. The Stamp Act, of course, is not the first money measure Lord Grenville has aimed at American colonists. With last year's Sugar Act and Currency Act and this year's Quartering Act, His Majesty's government is digging deeper and deeper into the pockets of the American colonial. And it all adds up to a lot of trouble during this time of post-war economic stress. 9 months ago, when the English Parliament was debating the Stamp Act bill, nobody anticipated this kind of reaction. The English press hardly mentioned the Stamp Act debates at all. And no one, including colonial agents in London, men like Benjamin Franklin, looked for such violent opposition as we're now seeing here in America. And when Parliament passed the Stamp Act by a very great majority, 205-4 and only 49 against, well, that definitely committed the English to enforce the law at all costs. But the Americans now seem just determined to oppose the Stamp Act even to the point of violent uprising. That's the conflict we may see resolved here today. For the crucial action seems likely to take place here in Williamsburg, where George Mercer at this very moment ponders his next step. But the fever of violence is abroad in the land. So we take you now to New York and Ned Calmer for the picture there. Come in, Ned Calmer.
There's a crowd of about 2,000 people here at the waterfront on the tip of Manhattan Island, and the music you hear is no serenade. It's directed against the British ship that has been in New York Harbor now for almost a week. The ship is loaded with stamps, and the British officials seem to be hesitant about unloading them in the face of this demonstration. Now, I've asked one of the demonstrators to sing this song into our microphone so you can get the word. Are you ready now?
Yes, sir.
Sing it
now.
I'll try.
Sing it
this next
time.
I'll sing it
after. The first right we hold shall never be sold, but sacred maintained to our grave. Nay and ere we'll comply, we will gallantly die. For we must not and will not be slaves, great boys. We must not and will not be slaves.
Thank you, sir. That, fought with a noble effort. Well, here in this lively city of 25,000 to 30,000 people, the second largest city in America after Philadelphia, almost all commerce, or what's left of it, has been stopped for this parade and demonstration. A crowd of artisans and laborers dressed in long pantaloons and leather breeches bundled up on this cold November morning in fur-lined overcoats and coonskin hats are making things a little warmer for themselves. Not only are they burning officials in effigy, but they've torn down the wooden palisades around Bowling Green and made a bonfire. Demonstrators are moving now. Heading the parade is a huge placard with skull and bones, and the placard reads, "Stamp Act, the folly of England and the ruin of America." I have here at the microphone a man who's been nailing up these posters all over town.
That's right.
And now, sir, will you read for our listeners the words on one of these posters you're carrying?
Read them. I know them by heart. It says, "Warning. The first man that either distributes or makes use of stamp and paper, let him take care of his house and person and effect. Signed, Vox Populi. We dare."
And Vox Populi?
That's me and the rest of New York.
I see. Thank you, sir. Well, that's pretty much the sentiment here in New York right now. And we switch you next to Boston and Larry LeSueur. Through the windows of the Green Dragon Tavern here on the Boston waterfront, we can see the ships in the harbor displaying their colors at half-mast. They're mourning the first day of the enforcement of the Stamp Act. Early today, Sam Adams, as you may have heard, the leader of the Boston Liberty Boys, harangued the crowd with this statement: "The people shout, and their shout will be heard to the distant end of this continent." There are, however, other voices than the Liberty Boys of Sam Adams here in Boston. There's other voices, fewer to be sure, represent the other side of this conflict. And here at our microphone is Mr. Martin Howard, a lawyer of Newport, Rhode Island. Mr. Howard, I take it that you believe that the colonists ought to pay the tax without protest.
I do. The act was passed by Parliament, and every British subject must abide by the law.
But it's argued, sir, that the colonists have no representation in Parliament, and this tax is what Edmund Burke called taxation without representation.
Edmund Burke may be a native of England, but he talks like a Philadelphia lawyer. The colonists, like all Englishmen, are represented in the House of Commons. But a member of Parliament represents not only his own constituency, but all Englishmen everywhere. The colonists have all personal rights, including those of life, liberty, and estate. And these rights are secured to us by the common law, which is every subject's birthright, whether born in Great Britain, on the ocean, or in the colonies. And it is in this sense they enjoy all the rights and privileges of Englishmen.
But isn't the question here one of political rather than personal rights, sir? Is it your opinion that the colonists actually enjoy political rights?
Political rights, this rabble. They burn respected British officials in effigy. They burn down the house of the tax collector. They riot through the streets. How can such people be trusted with political rights? It's monstrous, monstrous. Now, I beg you to excuse me, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Martin Howard. The riots that Mr. Howard spoke about referred to the parade this morning around the townhouse where the governor and his council hold office. The people carried effigies of British officials to the townhouse and shouted, "Liberty, property, no stamp." And they then proceeded to Andrew Oliver's house. He's the stamp master for Massachusetts. And as a result of some provocation, they say, destroyed the fences in front of his house, entered it, and then broke up the furniture. Nobody was hurt, however, and the action has not resulted in a practical resolution of this affair as of the present moment. The events in Williamsburg may well be the key ones in determining the outcome of the Stamp Act controversy. So back now to Williamsburg, Bill Leonard reporting.
George Mercer and Governor Fouquet are still debating. The promised 15 minutes are about up, and the tension increases by the second. We've moved our microphone to the Raleigh Tavern, where George Mercer is closeted with the governor and his council in the Daphne Room right next door. The crowd's made its way the two blocks from the Capitol to the street in front of the tavern here, and as many people as could squeeze in are now jammed into this little tavern. We're set up in the Apollo Room of the Raleigh, the most colorful room in this most colorful tavern in all Virginia. The band you hear playing in the background has certainly served to relieve some of the tension here. The Apollo Room, incidentally, takes its name from a room in the Devil's Tavern in London, which was frequented by Sir Walter Raleigh and Ben Jonson. Above the mantel across the room from me is a gilded motto, "Hilaratus sapienti et boni vitae prolix," translating into something like jollity, the offspring of wisdom and good living. good living in the colonies, it seems, will depend very much on Colonel Mercer's forthcoming statement. He's still not come out. Williamsburg, ordinarily a town of only 1,000 or 2,000, is swelled today by 4,000 or 5,000 visitors. It almost seems that most of them are in the Apollo room here. They're crowded together as we await Mr. Mercer's decision. And as always in the Raleigh, there are assembled here merchants and traders, adventurers, planters, all sorts of people. Here at our microphone is a sea captain. He's Captain Stephen McCready, I think that's right, and he's agreed to be interviewed. Captain, what cargo are you carrying these days?
Only wine in my belly. I've been drinking some excellent Madeira here, but sea cargo, oh no, sir. Merchants have almost forgotten my ship since all this fuss over the Stamp Act.
What ports do you usually sail to?
Liverpool, Curacao, Genoa, Amsterdam, wherever my cargo takes me. I tell you, sir, I've seen all kinds of foul weather, but I've yet to see a hurricane, and that's the one blowing up here in the colonies. But as far as cargo is concerned, me and every sea captain like me is becalmed. No cargo in Boston, no cargo in New York, no cargo in Philadelphia. Another month of this non-importation, and my ship will sink with the weight of the barnacles growing on its bottom.
Captain, are there any ships moving at all?
Only a few for the West Indies trade, but most British trade has stopped. Stopped because stamp paper is not available for clearances and bills of lading. That fellow Mercer better come to his senses, or no one will be able to afford to buy even stamps, much less goods. I've got a shilling or two for another bottle. Will you join me?
Thank you. I'd like to, Captain, but we're working here. But I expect that George Mercer will be coming out soon. From what I've been able to see here in Williamsburg, Captain McCready's views on business conditions are reasonably accurate. The bulletin board on the little porch in front of Raleigh Tavern is covered with all kinds of notices of auction sales of personal property. I'm going to move out to that porch in order to read off to you some of these notices and be ready for Governor Fouquet and Colonel Mercer when they address the crowd out front, as we expect they will. The crowd waiting here before the Raleigh Tavern extends far up and down Duke of Gloucester Street. Among them must certainly be some of the people who posted these auction sale notices here on the bulletin board. I see a notice of sale for a coach and 4 horses, and one for a house and a barn. There's one here for 6 Hereford cattle, and others for ships and taverns, shops, warehouses, slaves, even household goods and clothing are for sale, just about everything. And if this continues, Governor Fouquet has just come out to the Daphne room. I can see through the doorway that he's motioned the band to stop playing. He's coming out to the porch here to address the crowd. This is the moment we've all been waiting for. Now he's raising both his hands, and a hush is falling over the crowd here.
Gentlemen, Mr. George Mercer is ready to make a statement. Mr. Mercer.
Colonel Mercer is slowly making his way through the door out to the porch. He looks very much troubled. He seems reluctant to speak. Hesitating, but the crowd have their eyes on him. They're not pleading eyes, they're menacing eyes. He seems ready to speak now, and here he is.
Gentlemen, I arrived this morning to carry out my duty to enforce the Stamp Act. I do acknowledge that some little time before I left England, I heard of and saw some resolves which were said to be made by Mr. Patrick Henry in the House of Burgesses in Virginia. But as the authenticity of these resolves was disputed, I determined to know the real sentiments of my countrymen for myself. I know these sentiments now. And in view of them, I give you every assurance that I will not, directly or indirectly, by myself or my deputies, proceed in the execution of the Stamp Act.
The Stamp Act will not be enforced. Victory is victory here. Mr. Mercer will not enforce the Stamp Act. The crowd cheering wildly there. Carrying George Mercer on their shoulders, parading him through the streets, and he's laughing. Please, I suppose it needs to get an old friend again. Someone's beating his drum, the bells are ringing, and perhaps you can hear them. Even above this din of celebration, here from Bruton Harris, Captain, and William and Mary Collins. Tax collectors all over the colonies are certain to be resigning now. Andrew Oliver in Boston, Ingersoll in Hartford, Zacharias Ford in Maryland, Henry Van Schaik in Albany. This is indeed a victory. A victory of the American colonists against oppressive measures, against British autocratic rule, a victory that will transfer power from an aristocratic minority to a democratic majority.
November 1st, 1765. The American colonists reject the Stamp Act and win their first great battle against autocratic rule, paving the way for ultimate independence. You are there.
You've been listening to the Stamp Act Rebellion in the series You Are There. Today's program was written by Joseph Liss, edited by Irving Gitlin, and directed by John Dietz. You Are There is produced by the CBS Documentary Unit under the supervision of Werner Michel. Agatha Sterrett was played by Hester Sundergaard. Paul Mann was Patrick Henry. Eric Dressler was George Mercer. And Ralph Bell was Martin Howard, the lawyer. Others in the cast were various members of the ensemble. You Are There is brought to you every fourth Sunday. The next broadcast will be heard Sunday, April 16th, at this same time over most of these same stations next month.
480 B.C., the path at Thermopylae in ancient Greece. The heroic stand of Leonidas and 300 Spartans against the Persian invader. You are there.
That's the Relic Radio show for this week. I hope you enjoyed it. I'll be back next Tuesday with another one. In between now and then, there's more Favorite Story, You Are There, past episodes of the Relic Radio show, and thousands of other old-time radio shows, all at relicradio.com. You can listen to our Shoutcast stream there and donate through the website if you'd like to help support this and all of the shows. Your support makes it all possible. My thanks, as always, to those who have helped out. Thanks for joining me today. Talk to you again next week with another episode of the Relic Radio show.